Welcome to Lost Ladies of Lit, the podcast dedicated to forgotten women writers. I'm Kim Askew here with my co-host, Amy Helms.
Today, we are going to be learning our ABCs. The ABCs of how men will try to land you in the sack, or at least how men in New York City circa 1918 would have attempted it, according to today's Lost Lady.
Yes, and suffice to say, the tactics haven't changed all that much 100 years later.
Nope. ABC. It's easy to sleep with me. Don't need no marriage decree. I don't know how I'm working the Jackson 5 into this Lost Lady. I think it's the first and last time it will ever happen. But all you need to know is horn dog men will be horn dog men in any time or place or any language, come to think of it.
That's right, because the book we're discussing today was written in Yiddish.
Lucky for us, this fantastic novel has recently been published in English, Miriam Karpilov's Diary of a Lonely Girl, or The Battle Against Free Love, should honestly, in my opinion, be required reading for every young woman before they start dating.
Yes, it's so good, so funny, and yet disturbing, and also so eye-opening about the double standards in gender dynamics, both then and now.
We have the translator of this English edition on the show today to walk us through the alphabet of cringy men that Karpilov's fictional diary features.
This episode is going to be fantastic. I can't wait. So let's raid the stacks and get started.
Our guest today, Jessica Kurzain, is an assistant instructional professor in the Yiddish Department of Germanic Studies at the University of Chicago, and she's the editor-in-chief of In Geweb, a journal of Yiddish studies. Her translation of Miriam Karpilov's Diary of a Lonely Girl was published by Syracuse University Press in 2020. Last year, Francis Farlag Press published Jessica's translation of another work by Karpilov, a novel called Judith, A Tale of Love and Woe, and then also her translation of Karpilov's A Provincial Newspaper and Other Stories will be out with Syracuse University Press in September. So basically, she's a one-woman dynamo getting Karpilov's works out to the English-speaking world. I love it. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you so much. So before we begin, would you mind saying the title of Diary of a Lonely Girl in Yiddish? We wouldn't have the faintest idea of how to say it.
So the title in Yiddish is Tagebuch von einem elenden Mädel oder der Kampf gegen freie Liebe.
That's beautiful.
And confirms that I would never
say that. No.
So how did you come across this book and Miriam Karpilov, and what was your reaction?
So I was working on my dissertation at Columbia University about inter-ethnic romance between Jewish and non-Jewish people in Yiddish and English fiction in the early 20th century. And one of my dissertation advisors said that I needed a good footnote to define what free love meant in that context. But I was living far away from the research library that I was used to using. And so I basically only had the internet to finish up my footnotes. And I went on to the website of the Yiddish Book Center, which is a nonprofit organization that preserves Yiddish literature. It's a really phenomenal organization. They have digitized a huge quantity of Yiddish literature on their website. And I typed in Freie Liebe, which means free love in Yiddish, just to kind of see what hits I would get. But the second hit was this novel, because the subtitle is The Battle Against Free Love. And I opened it up and I started reading it. And I had never heard of Miriam Karpilov before. And she was phenomenal. So that was the beginning of it.
The magic of the internet. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the publication history of the book? How did it come about? When did it first appear? That sort of thing.
It was first published serially in a newspaper called Die Wahrheit, which means the truth, which was a Yiddish newspaper in New York. It was published between 1916 and 1917. And then immediately after the serialization finished, it came out in book form with absolutely no edits whatsoever in 1918 by a small Yiddish press in New York. And I don't know very much about the reception of the book, except that most serialized novels were not published in book form. So the very fact that it gets published that way right afterward suggests that it was quite popular, as well as the fact that the newspaper kept Karpolov on and she started publishing another serialized novel immediately after the first. Even before the book comes out in print, she's already got another one going. So the diary really sort of established her career as a novelist of serialized fiction. And the only reviews that exist are more like advertisements. They're within the pages of Die Wahrheit itself. And so they include reviews and letters praising the book, but it's hard to know if they are sort of constructed as advertisements. One of them is in the voice of a young woman who praises the book for giving voice to women's realities. One is in the voice of an Orthodox man who praises the book for showing the pitfalls of free love, presumably so that young men and women will turn to a more traditional marital relationship as a better alternative. So you can see the way that even the newspaper is kind of pitching it to their audiences.
This would have had people talking. I mean, how could it not, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe people would be scandalized. Maybe people would love it. But some eyebrows had to have been raised. So as you mentioned, because it's serialized and the book is written in a diary format, so the chapters or the diary entries, they're very short little installments, and it makes it very easy to read this book. I kind of would pick it up here and there throughout the day and read the next little bit. So can you, Jessica, give a little more of a rundown of who the diarist is and how this book unfolds?
Yeah. So our diarist doesn't have a name. She just refers to herself as me or I. And we don't know a lot about the details of her life. She's sort of an immigrant Jewish everywoman. So she's single. We know she's working, though we don't know at what. She has no family in America. She's probably in her late 20s or maybe her early 30s. And when we meet her, she's pining after someone she's had a relationship with, and the tone is rather melancholic. As she progresses through her courtships, the tone shifts to be much more cynical, although there are still some somber moments throughout. The courtships are all filtered through the diarist's perspective, but the novel is very dialogue heavy. So even though we're all getting it from her, we still hear the words of the suitors, sometimes ad nauseam. They take up a lot of the room in the book, even though they're in the pages of a woman's diary. It's like she still can't escape from them and even be able to get a word in edgewise, which is, I think, very funny.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. I love that perspective. Yeah.
So let's focus on the subtitle you mentioned, The Battle Against Free Love. This idea of freedom for women in the early 20th century being not entirely a good thing is something we've discussed at length in our previous episode on Ursula Parrott's Ex-Wife. Karpolov's book predates Ex-Wife by a decade, and it also contemplates the pitfalls of being a new woman. But whereas Ex-Wife's protagonist was a fashionable flapper, in this book, the protagonist is a working-class Russian-Jewish immigrant. Jessica, can you talk a little bit more about the argument Karpolov wants to make with this book?
Yeah. So I just listened to the episode on Parrott yesterday. I was so excited about the parallels. I think it might be helpful to think through what free love means in this context and how it might be the same or different from a flapper lifestyle. So Karpolov's narrator is living amidst a population of immigrants who had come from the Russian Empire, many of whom had already been exposed to radical politics in their home countries. Karpolov herself emigrated around the time of the failed 1905 revolution from the area around Minsk. And these Jewish immigrants arrived to become part of the working class in an industrial city in working conditions where there was inadequate pay, long hours, no health and safety standards to speak of. And these conditions made areas of dense Jewish settlement hotbeds of activism, anarchism, and socialism. Among the principles of anarchism was advocacy for free love, which was an opposition to religious and governmental authority that they believe impeded on the freedom of the individual. So free love was, in principle, not about sexual liberation or about having lots of casual sexual relationships. You could actually be in a long-term monogamous free love relationship as long as you insisted on keeping state and religious authorities out of your bedroom. But in this moment, free love also as a term gets thrown around both in Yiddish and in English for a way of thinking about a more general and less theoretically grounded idea of modern sexual liberation. So Karpolov kind of makes fun of radical immigrant men who claim to be politically idealistic, but it seems are largely simply interested in having sex. And more to the point, they want to have sex without the responsibilities of marriage. If individuals try to have relationships outside of marriage, without a systemic overhaul of the patriarchy, then living outside of marriage is ultimately just another way for men to exploit women's bodies and leave them vulnerable. One might even say that Karpolov argues that free love is kind of like the adjunctification of marriage. Women are still expected to perform sexual and emotional labor, but in an unstable working environment in which the men can simply get bored and break up with them, at which point the women will be considered used goods and less valuable on the marriage market. Free love is a kind of exploitative labor condition for women, championed by men who see themselves as political radicals advocating against poor labor conditions, but don't see that women are wrapped up in these very terrible conditions.
I mean, how convenient wrapping it up in this lofty, noble package. That is hilarious,
right?
Yeah.
And we see that. I mean, we see that in one of the men in particular in this book, which we'll get to in a little bit. So when I think of famous Russian Jewish women in New York City at this time, it's easy to land on somebody like Emma Goldman, who was a champion for free love. We see her as a revolutionary and this feminist tour de force, but Karpolov was being radical in her pushing back against Goldman's ideas.
It's very interesting, right? Because Goldman is sort of a felt presence in this book. There's even a moment when one of the suitors that she dates goes to give a lecture and someone says, oh, he could fit Emma Goldman in his pockets or something like that. So she kind of gets a call out and she's very much all over the pages of the newspapers where Miriam Karpolov would have been writing. But there are ways in which she kind of pushes back against what Emma Goldman is saying. So one way this manifests is in birth control, which figures really interestingly in this text. There's one scene in which a suitor is trying to convince the narrator to have sex, and he argues that women are only really concerned about what he calls the results of sex, which is to say, getting pregnant. He says, you know, euphemistically, I have a way, I have birth control, so she doesn't need to be concerned. But the narrator is really not reassured by this declaration because she's not only trying to avoid pregnancy, she's trying to avoid having sex at all. First of all, she doesn't seem to want it. But secondly, she's aware that it would be a misstep that would have really serious social consequences for her. The possibility that a woman might get pregnant, she says, is her only defense against unwanted sex. So if you take that away via birth control, a woman will have less power in a relationship of the kind that Karpolov's narrator always seems to find herself in, a relationship in which she is this kind of gatekeeper against sex, constantly using her wit and her willpower to fend it off. She's sort of saying, like, the only quiver in my bow is don't have sex with me, I might get pregnant. And birth control, while it may allow for the possibility of free love, if free love is bad for women, so is birth control.
Yeah. And just going back to what you said about her being alone in America without her family, she only has herself to fall back on. She has no one there to help her in like her battle against all these male suitors.
The only way that she's powerful is rhetorically, right?
Yeah. And she is powerful.
Like, there are a couple of moments when she sort of like scratches someone with her fingernails. And there's a kind of like physicality to it, but a lot of it is rhetorical. And so there's a kind of elevation of language itself as a kind of defense mechanism.
Yeah. And she has everything to lose, her reputation, which is all she has on her own.
Right. Her reputation is her opportunity for housing, is her opportunity for any kind of potential marriage in the future, which is also like the opportunity for stability and so forth, and respectability.
Yeah. So much of the action, and not just the action that the men want to have happen, but the events in the book, they take place in her lodgings. Could you give us some historical context in terms of the living situation for single ladies, particularly at this time, and what was so precarious about it? We touched a little bit on that, but it was a bit scary for her.
Yeah, she has a lot of independence. She can go out and socialize with men and women. She can hang out in public parks and flirt, go to parties. But she also lives in these rented rooms where her behavior is monitored by her landladies, who want to keep up appearances of being respectable for themselves and for their own families and daughters. And so the only opportunity that she has to stay in these places is by keeping up a reputation. And this is compounded by changing laws that police the behavior of single working class women. So in one passage, the narrator refers to the effects of the activities of the Committee of 15, which was a vice commission created by the New York Chamber of Commerce, who turned their attention to the problem of prostitution in tenement houses and apartment buildings. And among the stipulations of their Tenement House Act of 1901, a woman caught in the act of prostitution in a tenement house could be arrested and imprisoned for up to 6 months. And so this puts the narrator in some extremely tight spots. When she's alone in her room and a man is making unwanted sexual advances, what can she do? If she screams and someone finds a man in her room, she could be arrested and sent to prison. In one scene, the narrator runs out of her room to be in public, but then she sees a policeman and she worries about what he's going to think about the man chasing after her and whether he will suspect her of prostitution, when what she's really trying to do is actually just get away from this man. So he has so much power over her because he knows about these laws. He knows that the policeman will believe him as a man sooner than he'll believe a woman. And so he has all the power in the situation, both in the terms of sort of like physically being able to force himself on her and also being able to threaten that he can turn her over to the law.
It's just like a dragnet effect. So many innocent women could just get caught up in this. You tick somebody off and they're going to say, oh, this lady living over here by herself, you better go check her out, you know?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable that they were allowed to do that and throw women in jail.
Yeah, it's really incredible. A book I would really recommend about this is by Sadia Hartman, Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, which is especially about the African-American community and the way that these laws get employed to police the private lives of people. But it's really shocking.
So you told us a little bit about Karpalev earlier. Do we know anything else about her life and how it might have dovetailed with the diarist of this book?
Yeah, she was definitely living in rented rooms. She was probably about the same age as the diarist. But one major difference between Miriam Karpalev and her diarist is that she was not lonely. She had a large family. She was one of 10 children. She was born in 1888 in a small town outside of Minsk in what is now Belarus and was then in the Russian Empire. And then in 1905, she came to America and she settled in Bridgeport, Connecticut, where she had several brothers. And she later lived in New York City in various places. She moved quite a lot like her narrator. But it seems like often she was living with family members. So that's a major difference. She began writing for newspapers at the age of 18. At first, she was writing for humor magazines, kind of like the Onion for the Yiddish press. So some of this was like uncredited things, like a long list of jokes or a list of aphorisms. And sometimes it was more credited work. And in 1911, she published her first novel, which was Judith, written as a series of letters from a small town young Jewish woman to her lover, a revolutionary from a wealthy city who she only met in person on a handful of occasions. She starts out as this like painfully teenage infatuated girl. And then she matures as she's writing letters to this person and she doesn't know if he's being faithful to her. When Miriam Karpalev began serializing Diary of a Lonely Girl in 1916, that gave her the recognition of a wider audience, but also the stability of a regular income. She started publishing short stories and serialized novels in the Wahrheit until 1920. Which is when the Wahrheit closed. She works for a short time for a Boston Yiddish newspaper. And then she departs to Palestine in 1926 with her brother and some other family members in the hopes of settling there. But 3 years later, she came back to the States, complaining that she couldn't make a living as a Yiddish writer in Palestine. And it took her a little while to land on her feet, but eventually she was hired as a staff writer for the largest Yiddish newspaper in New York. And I don't know that much about her dating life, but it definitely seems like she had one. Mm-hmm. And so probably some of this is things that she experienced firsthand, and some of this probably things that her friends experienced. And it seems like she was very close to several cousins who were also in this kind of dating world. So yeah, I do think it has a kind of drawn from reality feel to it, even if not all of it is her own personal experience.
All right, so let's leap into our discussion of this book. We'll start, I guess, at the beginning of the alphabet. So can you talk about the character A? And maybe you'd want to read a brief passage to help listeners get a feel for what's going on at the start of the book.
Yeah. So we don't see A for all that long. She's had some kind of romance with him, and it seems clear that what she wants is something like marriage, and what he wants is what he would describe as free love. And she's really dissatisfied, and they kind of break up, and then she's in despair for a long time. So I'll just read a very short piece so you can get a sense. For a while, it seemed to me that if he only knew how I suffer, he would give everything else up for me, even his love for the other unknown woman who peeks at him from among his grandiose plans for the future. I hate his love. I don't want it anymore. A love that has no future is not worth anything in the present. Distant relationships are only good when they are followed by closer ones. You can be a free thinker about everything else, but not about love. Love requires fanatics. A is not one. He's a casual gambler who risks exactly as much as he doesn't mind losing.
I love it. But I will say, we're meeting A at the beginning of the book. She's pining away over him. She's a little stalkerish. She's walking by his apartment window.
Obsessed. She's obsessed.
I thought to myself, oh, I don't know if I can do this, because it was a little too familiar
too
to me.
Familiar. Me too. I've been there, girl.
I mean, I didn't stalk anybody, but I remember all those conversations with your girlfriends where you're parsing it out.
Waiting for the call, checking your voicemail.
Oh my God. And I was just like, oh, I lived this. I don't need to do it again. But things start to change a lot. As you said, we move on to Mr. B and Mr. C. And really, the whole tone of the book starts to shift.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, I want to say like bachelor number two, but it's
letter B.
Bachelor letter B. He's quite a charmer. He does and says all the right things, but there is a major problem. Jessica, yeah. Explain.
Well, yeah. I mean, the major problem is that he's married. And not only that, but his wife gets pregnant and he still wants to keep this affair going.
His attempts at an affair, right?
Right.
I mean, nothing happened between them. He keeps hitting on her and hitting
on her. Exactly. Like, she's letting him into her room, right? So there is a kind of intimacy in the sense that she's allowing him to court her, but it's not a consummated affair. He even wants to name his baby after the narrator.
Oh, yeah. That is so creepy.
It's really creepy, right?
She's like, I hate this guy.
Yeah. That's like, that's too much for her. She can't. She never was like super serious. He was supposed to make A jealous, or he was supposed to be kind of the rebound guy. But these like cloying letters where he does things that are really just too much, she just has to figure out a way to get away from him.
I started to think of her as like a early 20th century Janine Garofalo from Reality Bites. If you remember that character, she's depressed for sure, but she's also so funny and she has so much cynical self-awareness about all of it. So at one point, she winds up having to leave her first lodgings because of all the drama with some of the initial guys. Her landlady is suspicious of her. So she goes and finds a new place to live and she writes of the new landlords, I didn't hate them so much as I knew that I was going to hate them later on.
I love that. Like,
put it on a t-shirt.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
So that's her personality. It's so good.
I tell my friends that Miriam Karpolov would have been really good at Twitter. Like, she's got so many one-liners.
Oh, I love that. Absolutely. So this deadpan humor of hers, it comes into play quite a bit when she meets Bachelor number three. He's our C of the story. He's a young philosophy student she meets at the library. And despite being kind of grungy and unkempt, I mean, gross a little bit, at first he seems like maybe he does have potential, but he's just itching to get into her pants. And he tries so hard, it gets really comical. And the narrator just manages to run circles around him in their debates over whether or not she ought to sleep with him or live a little. He keeps imploring her to live a little. He's going to teach her how to live.
Yeah, and it is really funny, but it's like borderline almost not funny, right?
Yeah,
because the reality is, in that time period, a lot of women, that would have turned into something horrible, a rape. Can I just read one little section here? So he's in the apartment at night. And she's like, you're trying to seduce me and you're being really loud about it. We're going to get caught and I don't want you doing it anyway. So would you please just shut up? And he says, okay, but don't you know that when I close my mouth, I have to speak with my hands? A man must have some way to express his passion. And so she says, go away, go home, go. I begged him. Biting my lips to quell my distress, I grabbed his fresh hands and frantically pushed them away with all my strength. "Oh, my darling," he said, his passion increasing with my actions. "You beg me to leave, but you are holding my hands. How like a woman. When a woman says no, she means yes. It's a woman's nature. She wants to be taken by force so she can claim later that she didn't ask for it. Women are complicated. But you, my darling, try too hard to suppress your desires. Why should you fight it? It's for your own happiness as well as mine. Instead of holding a man back, a woman should help him achieve happiness." I did not feel like helping him achieve happiness. I felt that I'd feel a lot better if he were on the other side of the door.
Yeah.
So I love that she's literally fighting him off and he's like, "See, you're touching me. You love it."
And it's almost like an aside to her reader, like, "Reader, I didn't want to help him." You know, like, see, it takes up so much space in the book. But I think that's kind of the point. Like, we can really get the full experience of his relentlessness and his verbosity. And our narrator is so pithy. She hears him out for so long that it makes it so clear that we know and she knows that he's making a fool of himself. And then she answers with these kind of like one sentence answers that just deflate him. And he doesn't always even notice how funny it is that he's talking so much and that she can just like cut it down with one sentence.
Yeah, her verbal sparring is amazing. So you could see why she would want to hang out with all these people that she could kind of debate with and talk with, but then they always just want to take it too far.
Yeah, take it to this level.
Yeah.
The discussions with C are just priceless.
Yeah, don't you want to be free of you? Yes, she said. Like, just lines like that all the way through. Was it hard to translate the humor into English? I mean, to find the right words to keep it funny?
Yeah, it was. I think, first of all, Yiddish is not my first language. So to make sure that I understood that it was a joke and trying to like pick up on all these innuendos. So you mentioned that he uses this euphemism living for having sex. And he uses the same one in Yiddish, leben, to live. But it took me a while to really trust myself that I was getting the joke or that I was getting the shades of meaning there. And then to try to make sure that it was transferring correctly, all these euphemisms, I have ways instead of birth control or whatever. And there were definitely some moments when initially it wasn't getting across and I had to kind of like ask my friends, well, is it funny? Did it work? And then come back and fix it to make it funny.
Yeah, not only did you have to translate it, but you had to make sure that the humor was there too. I mean, I feel like humor must be the hardest thing to translate.
But it is really fun because then you get to be a humor writer. Like,
yeah, that's true.
Funny enough to do it myself with her backing, I could do it.
I don't know. We might be better at it than you think.
And that idea of, you know, live a little, life is short. She hits on all of these time-worn chestnuts that men have always used to get women between the sheets. Like, men don't want a virgin, or everybody's doing it, or nobody will ever have to know, or I know how to be safe.
And there's also the chapter that I titled Mutual Consent. He says, "I think you should sleep with me, but I won't force you. I want your consent every step of the way." But then he sort of keeps insisting on her consent in a way that is deeply non-consensual.
Mm-hmm.
And so even just the idea of him saying he wants her consent is sort of funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, repeatedly, he would say things like, "I'm never going to talk to you again," or "I'm going now. I'm going." And she'd be like, "Okay, go." And then you'd be like, "No, I mean it. I'm really going." And she's like, "I heard you the first time and you're still standing here." Like, he just keeps turning up, even though she's shot him down a million times. Like, suddenly he'll be at the door again.
Yeah. So she also uses a lot of battle metaphors in the book. And as we mentioned, that's a word in the subtitle too. Can you talk about the imagery of combat and why it was such a useful metaphor at the time the book was published?
Yeah. So the word in Yiddish kampf is battle or struggle. So it's a word that would be used both in the labor movement, right? The struggle for workers' rights. And I really went back and forth about whether it should be the struggle against free love, the battle against free love. But I chose battle to relate it to the idea of the battle of the sexes, but also to remind readers about other battles that are happening at the same moment, because this is a novel that's coming out during World War I. And it's coming out in a newspaper. So it's appearing alongside both kind of like news pieces about the war. And also there was a serialized book that came out in the same newspaper at the same time called Tagebuch von der Milchome, or War Diary, a firsthand account about a Belgian resident at the outbreak of World War I. So it's very much of that context and is a kind of commentary or reportage about life on the home front at a time of war. another kind of battlefield that's distant but not disconnected from the theater of war, and introducing this kind of like firsthand experience of a woman in the heat of romantic battle. So I think it's a helpful context, although the narrator rarely mentions the war itself or the devastation that it wrought on Jewish communities caught in the midst of the war. But it still feels to me like a wartime novel with this kind of underlying acknowledgement of the turmoil that's happening at the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting context. That absolutely makes sense.
So we've mentioned bachelors A, B, and C. By the end of the novel, she has also introduced D, E, and F to us. They kind of round out the story. And as she goes along, she takes a stronger and stronger defensive stance with these men. She's just like, I can tear through these guys, no problem now. I'm learning my way as I go. But there are a few other women in the book, the most important being the narrator's good friend, Ray. They don't always see eye to eye. Do you want to mention anything relating to that character?
I guess Ray seems much more desperate. She's kind of pathetic in a lot of ways. I'm not sure if this novel would pass the Bechdel test. When Ray and the narrator get together, they mostly talk about their romantic relationships. They talk about guys. But there is a kind of solidarity in that, even though they're sometimes competing for the same men's affections. They're both doing it in an environment of scarcity, in which they know that any man they get is really not such a prize. So Ray's mere existence is kind of a breath of fresh air. There's the possibility of a relationship that's not dangerous on actually so many fronts, because Ray doesn't threaten the narrator physically, but there's this one moment when a nosy landlady thinks she's finally caught the narrator in an inappropriate act and is ready to throw her out of the building. And she knocks on the door to find that the narrator's overnight guest was actually a woman, was Ray. And it's inconceivable to the landlady that anything untoward could be happening between two women. That's just something that she would have considered. And so the presence of a woman rather than a man offers the narrator some safety from her landlord's prying eyes as well. So there's a kind of like, even though Ray is sort of pathetic in some ways, she's also an oasis for the narrator, and almost like a way out for the narrator.
The landlady kind of brought to mind Three's Company and Mr. Roper, always snooping outside the door, like waiting to catch her.
The one who could put her plant in there or something.
Yeah, she puts a plant in the room.
She has to keep coming in and watering it. That's hilarious.
It is. There are some very sitcom-y moments for sure.
Absolutely. I like what you mentioned about the scarcity, because I think that's a good point. And there's a scene where they're all at the park and all the women are falling all over. The men are surrounding the one guy. I think it's B. Everyone's into him. And when you point out the scarcity of options, too, I think that also shows a little bit about what's going on.
And you said earlier you didn't feel like she was interested in having sex, but I kept going back and forth with that, because I think definitely she was into the idea of being in love. You know, she was into the idea of a relationship and
companionship.
I do want companionship.
And maybe even making out. But
I think she was tempted at times. I think she was physically tempted.
And she says also over and over again, like, anything is better than being lonely. I don't want to be lonely. I'll tolerate this for a little while longer, because at least I won't be lonely. And this is with a lot of sort of modern literature at the turn of the 20th century, and the anonymity of the city and so forth, right? There's this kind of like desperation for connection. She's deeply lonely, and that seems to drive a lot of her desire.
The way she talks and thinks actually ends up feeling so current. And if you swap out the handwritten letters for texts and the streetcars for subways, it could really ring true even today. Maybe not in all respects, but in some. Is that modern feeling something you brought to it in your translation, or does it feel that way in original Yiddish too?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really does. I've taught the book a number of times, and so have colleagues. They've told me that it really lands well, especially with university students. It has, you know, similar kind of feeling to young dating life today. And also, university students are away from their families for the first time. They're living in small temporary rented spaces with a kind of communal policing happening as well sometimes, right? And so it's a very familiar feeling for especially a lot of readers who are in that situation. I wouldn't say it's modern Yiddish. It's old. It sounds kind of clunky, much more, say, German inflected than current Yiddish. The spelling is older. But I did opt to keep the language sort of fresh and contemporary and try not to make it clunky, although I spent a lot of time looking in sort of slang dictionaries or like just get a sense of like what language people were actually using in the 1920s. I read a lot of Edna Ferber, Dorothy Parker, things like that while I was translating to kind of get a sense for what that language should feel like, even though I wasn't trying to make it exactly like that kind of language. So kind of balancing between those things. I think maybe the hardest thing for me was actually bringing across the language politics of the text. There are characters who use Russian words in order to show off how educated they are, or who speak Yiddish with a German accent, or who throw in English to show off how they've assimilated into American culture. So how do you translate when a character who's speaking Yiddish throws in an English word? It's hard to share that level of like multilingual nuance with an English audience. So that's why there's a glossary at the back of the book and there's some words that are left untranslated just to give a flavor for the language politics of the text.
Yeah, your notes are very helpful on that.
We already kind of talked about this a little bit, the fact that the narrator is, she's really not a prude. She's a strong, cool, modern girl earning her own money. So her refusal to sleep with these guys is not so much about being afraid or like prissy or, you know, anything like that. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add on that.
But yeah, I really think it's about like bodily autonomy. It's about her being able to decide whether or not to have sex and make a decision for herself rather than being swayed by men who seem to want it more than she does or for whom there are fewer consequences.
And she's so intelligent. So it's insulting to her the way they're treating her. You know, she's too smart for them.
Especially C. There's a moment when she says, like, you tried to devalue me in my own eyes so that I will sleep with you, right? Like, if you lower my self-worth, then you can get a bargain, she says. And he keeps harping on, you're getting old, you're not so pretty anymore, you should live while you still have the opportunity. And so he's really trying to deflate her in order to have sex with her, which is really repulsive, and she sees right through it.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say, readers, you'll read this book wondering, will she or won't she give in? And we won't spill the beans on that. You just need to read it and discover that for yourself.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say about Karpalov or this book that we might not have touched on yet?
Well, I guess like the one thing that maybe it would be cool for your listeners to know is that we happen to be in a moment where there is an explosion of interest and attention to and translations of women who wrote in Yiddish. Really in the past, maybe 5 years, 6 years, there's been just like an enormous sea change in what gets translated from Yiddish.
We did do a one other Yiddish translation episode. It was Deborah Vogel, Acacia's Bloom.
Yeah, I heard that one.
Which is very different from this. It was very experimental and interesting too. If listeners want to go back, we'll put that one in our show notes too.
Yeah. And actually the year that I was translating Diary of a Lonely Girl, Anastasia Lubas was in my cohort of translation fellows when she was translating Deborah Vogel. So, which is again, like this kind of explosion. It's all happening at once.
That's great. Well, this is a book that I will not soon forget for sure. I loved it. I'm so glad you brought it to our attention.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's great. We're able to read this book today. Thanks to you. And thank you for being on the show.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoy the podcast. I listen to it all the time. I listen to it while I go jogging.
Oh my gosh. That's the best. Thank you.
So that's all for today's episode. Be sure to join us over on our Lost Ladies of Lit Facebook forum. It's a group where we're posting fun stuff like bonus clips from each episode and then sneak previews also of upcoming episodes.
Yeah, we're having so much fun over there talking with listeners and everybody sharing links, and it's really fun. So also, please consider leaving us a 5-star review if you're enjoying our show. We'd really appreciate the feedback, and it helps new listeners find us.
Our theme song was written and performed by Jenny Malone, and our logo was designed by Harriet Grant. Lost Ladies of Lit is produced by Amy Helms and Kim Askew.